Thank you. pretty glad you're here.
Testing, testing.
Yes, so you're right.
Your slides are first.
Oh, they are?
Yeah.
Okay, easy.
I'm late for a very important date. I'm late. Okay, you guys, we're going to get started again. Please take your places, your allotted spots. Our next presentation is a theme panel on healthcare experiences in medically underserved geographic areas. Our first presenter is Dr. Gomez from UCSF in Fresno, and Dr. North from UNM, University of New Mexico.
Hi, everybody. So I'm Ivan Gomez. I'm at UCSF Fresno. I was the residency director there for about 12 years, and 3 years ago I decided to take the slightly less busy job of department chief, and I became the director of the statewide AHEC about the same time, so who knew. So I'm talking a little bit about healthcare experiences in medically underserved geographic areas, talk a little bit about what we do at UCSF Fresno and also with the AHEC program in California. So like a lot of the programs you've heard today, pretty much do some kind of programs that address things throughout the spectrum from high school through residency and postgraduate training. I won't talk too much about LACMERIS is Latino Center for Medical Education and Research that's based at UCSF Fresno. Suffice it to say, their Doctors Academy has been in place under leadership of Catherine Flores there for, over 20 to 25 years now, and we're starting to see dividends on that. We've had several junior high and high school students that have come through that program that are actually now practicing primary care physicians, and mainly in family medicine and pediatrics, so it's been a great program. The AHEC, which is one of the hats that I wear, mainly focuses on health profession student training, PAs, nurse practitioners, undergraduates, pharmacy students, and it builds upon existing programs that exist statewide. You heard one of them yesterday based at the Scripps program, so one of our high-performing centers there for sure. The AHEC Scholars Program is a curriculum that we've developed. You'll hear more about that. Statewide, across the 13 centers that we have, we train about 13,000 learners per year in some respect. We touch 13,000 people. The unique thing about California's AHEC is the vast majority of the student education takes place within the community health center system. Most recently, in fact, just a couple of months ago, UCSF Fresno received LCME accreditation for a regional medical school campus in the Central Valley of California, which is a long time in coming. And with that comes a reboot of the San Joaquin Valley Prime program, which is designed to expand the number of students that do the majority of their training within the Central Valley. And then, of course, we have our GME programs. So in California, like I mentioned, the AHEC there really bases its sites within medically underserved areas, largely within community health centers and health consortium networks. It's a unique model to California in that most of our learner base really comes from the ground up in terms of where they're trained. A couple of examples of things that we're doing in Fresno. Central Valley AHEC, one of our sites, partnered with a local FQHC to start a HRSA-based teaching health center in West Fresno. It serves a very underserved area. PA residency has been developed in Fresno, and we provide support through this through the AHEC program to some of our partners in different parts of the state. And the AHEC Scholars Curriculum, which I mentioned earlier, this is actually a federally mandated program. It was designed to improve academic community partnerships. In California, we feel we have that down pretty well, and so what we've done is we've designed curriculum to increase the knowledge on social determinants of health and provide increased community engagement opportunities with a required community project that allow these AHEC scholars that participate longitudinally to work with their AHEC center sites. This is kind of the breakdown of where our sites are based today. Like I said, most of them are based in community clinics. We have one that's based in an independent 501c at the Central Coast, and then we have now three that are based within family medicine residency programs across the state. San Joaquin Valley Prime, so this was recently renamed the UCSF San Joaquin Valley Prime. The idea here is really to ensure that the majority of students that are trained in the medical school program are based at UCSF Fresno, really to increase their exposure to the Valley. Ultimately, the plan is to expand from 12 students to 50 students per year. That gives me a no small degree of heartburn in terms of trying to find bandwidth to, you know, actually train all these students and still have spots to train residents. three campuses, UC Davis, San Francisco, and Merced, are all combining together to really kind of form a unique curriculum that's focused on the needs of the Central Valley. This is kind of a visual that kind of describes the progress. San Joaquin Valley Prime's coming in right here. It's in black because I'm dreading it over here in 2021. And then as far as our residency program here, the department here, basically we've developed some additional relationships with other teaching sites to be able to handle this bandwidth. One thing that we've done to really kind of tease in our community health center partners is really kind of give them a stepwise level of engagement. Almost all community health centers do some kind of outward community program, mobile health clinics, health fairs, and so forth. And even at this level, giving medical students that degree of involvement while they're in Fresno provides an opportunity for them to become more engaged with what's happening in the community. Second level for those that are kind of ready for it would be to base medical students' continuity clinics within the health center. So one unique thing about UCSF, recently they converted their curriculum to a longitudinal curriculum. So basically their pediatrics rotation experience, for example, instead of being over a 1 month period, is stretched over like every Monday afternoon for 6 months, and so on with other areas. Family medicine, we've been able to secure that as a 1 day every other week for the duration of medical school. So they'll actually get a training experience in family medicine for 4 years. And then ultimately, with some of the great work that's being done at the California Primary Care Association, then identifying potential sites for residency development as well. So the idea here is, the kind of hope and potential here is that if we have medical students actually come to Fresno, work in a community health center, they usually start seeing patients about 18 months in, that they see patients through 30 months, so 2.5 years of medical student training. Hopefully they'll stay in Fresno for their residency training, do another 3 years of continuity training, and in a discussion with our program and our dean, we've come up with a plan to help fit a secondary continuity of care site for those medical students. So if they're San Joaquin Valley Prime students, come and do a continuity experience in a clinic and then stay on as a resident in our program, they'll be able to continue to see the panel of patients in that clinic. And so potentially, by the time they finish training, they may have had a panel of patients for 5.5 years, which is a great potential for those community health center sites. This kind of is a visual of kind of shown to some of the CEOs of the community health center sites that we're working at. The cloud here represents kind of the pie in the sky. We all like them to eventually get to, from new, brand new medical students coming up to being able to practice as faculty within their sites. So, just real briefly, our family medicine program, over 400 graduates now. About a third, a little more than a third, are still practicing within the Central Valley, which has been great. We work with a lot of different partners, and the list is ever expanding. 100% of our training takes place within underserved sites and community health centers. In 2017, we were approved to expand to 16 residents per year. We're currently in the progress of expanding to 15 per year because of funding, which would make us, I think, would tie us to be the biggest program in California. So and that's all I have. Thank
you. Good. So we're going to change slides here. I'd just like to point out that I'm from New Mexico, which is part of the United States of America. New Mexico is the fifth largest state in the union, and we are a member of the union. We're union members. So we have about 2 million people, and if you took all the people in New Mexico and distributed them evenly throughout the state, they would all be socially isolated and lonely. Just to give you an idea how large the state is. I'm Chuck North. I'm a family doctor and a human being. I know that's redundant. I grew up in Seattle, Washington, did my residency in Minnesota, went to medical school in Pittsburgh, and then started in Indian Health in 1977. I graduated from the Indian Health Service and retired in after 31 and a quarter years after being the chief medical officer in Rockville in 2008. This is my fun retirement job working at the University of New Mexico, where I'm a professor of family and community medicine, the vice chair of the department, and the senior medical director for patient-centered medical home and the primary care practices. And what I'm going to do today is talk to you about some pipeline programs. So my office is actually right next to diversity, equity, and inclusion, and we have a pipeline. We don't start at the first prenatal visit, which Hector said they do in Los Angeles, but we do start in elementary and middle school with pipeline programs to encourage underrepresented minority and rural students to go into medicine. First of all, to study science and then to go into medicine. So we have pipelines all the way through the college level for medicine and pharmacy and science. So we are a majority minority state, I think one of four now, including Hawaii. We're growing a diverse health workforce. We've reached out to about 350 students a year, and over the last 6 or 7 years, we've touched about 2,000 student lives through the pipeline programs. Okay, now I'm going to talk about four different programs. That was one. The second one is the BAMD program. Now, a lot of schools have had BAMD programs for a long time, where you take students out of high school, and there are accelerated programs. Brown University had one that I was familiar with when I was a resident. I was actually on the faculty at Brown University when I lived on the Hopi Reservation. I had a faculty appointment. I went there once to run the Boston Marathon and use the parking place, and I met the people. It was really cool. So they have a different kind of BAMD program. We have one that is a partnership program between the undergraduate school, School of Arts and Science. It's BA, not a BS degree. The program is designed to help alleviate the physician shortage in rural New Mexico, particularly in underserved urban areas. It expanded the medical school class from 75 to 100.
And it's 103 or so. It just depends on how many people make it through on time. We admit a broadly diverse class of 28 now, so we can get 25 at the other end, high school seniors. So I was on the BAMD admissions committee after I retired. I was like 61 years old, and I was interviewing 17-year-olds that just learned how to drive, had braces and acne. And they hadn't developed their personality even yet. So it's really interesting to interview 17-year-olds who want to become doctors. But a few of them that I interviewed got in. One of them now is a radiology resident of all things. She had two children, one as an undergrad. I went to her graduation. She had one in medical school. She had a very supportive husband. Father died, which is why she went into medicine, because he had cancer when she started. And it was really, really interesting to watch this young lady develop. She's from a rural part of New Mexico, and I don't know what she's going to do, but it shows you the affirmative action part of the program. I think we often add an extra layer of responsibility to underrepresented minority and rural students, saying they have to go back and practice with their people in their small town. But some of them just want to get the hell out of the small town, the Indian reservation, the barrio, or the ghetto, and become like the white male physicians they see at the university. So I think it's good that she did that for her. But the BAMD program has 13 cohorts now, four undergraduate, four School of Medicine, and five have graduated. Excuse me. The largest proportion of the group is Hispanic, which is not surprising in New Mexico. The second largest is non-Hispanic whites, and then American Indian and Asian and Pacific Islanders. Vietnamese are listed separately, with African Americans at only 4%. We have over probably around 7,000 to 10,000 Vietnamese people in Albuquerque, which isn't obvious to people who don't live there. So the graduates now will have the 100th graduate of the program in this year. They're three times more likely to match in family medicine. And 14 of the BAMD students have completed their residencies, and 10 are now practicing in New Mexico. The new class coming in, 20 of 28 are rural, and 75% of the students are underrepresented minority students. Okay, that's program two. Program three is the Rural and Urban Underserved Program, or RUP, we call it. It's an innovative four-year medical school program for students who are matriculated in school, and they start in their first year. A lot of students come in very idealistic, right? And then we beat it out of them, and they do something else, and they become cynical and burned out. So this tries to capture students who are at the height of their ethical and social responsibility, and provide them experiences that will inspire them to continue in their idealistic pathway. So we mentor these students, and we provide opportunities for them to work in communities that they desire to work in when they start medical school. If you look at the ethnicity, it's about even between Hispanic and non-Hispanic, 14 Asian and 5 Native American students. 43% are not rural, 29% are, and 42% are disadvantaged financially. So this is the result of the match this year. We think they're all going to go where they're headed right now, but things can change between now and the end of June. So 8 in family medicine, 3 in OB, 2 in psychiatry, 1 peds, 1 going into an MPH program. Okay, that was the third program. The fourth one I want to talk about is the IHS-UNM Family Medicine Residency Program that I started with Art Kaufman and Bert Umland in 1996. We took our first residents. We started it in 95, and first match was 96, so it's 23 years old now. I think that's about how long I've been coming. No, I've been coming to this for 26 years now. So it was right after starting to come to Coastal Research. So of this group, 27% of the residents who matched in the IHS pathway for their residency are Native American, which is, I think, higher than anywhere in the country. excuse me, on any residency pathway. And 64% of the residents who finished are working in either Indian Health Service, federally operated Indian Health Service site, tribally or Native corporation operated sites, or urban Indian programs, which are like community health centers for urban Indians, like in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Denver, Seattle, Minneapolis, and Albuquerque mostly. So this is a picture of some of our graduates. And that's it. So I don't know if I finished on time. Close. Neil said he had a very hard question he was going to ask me, so I'm dying to hear what it is. And while he's coming up here, Neil, I just wanted to say I had the opportunity to meet the first Hopi Indian woman physician as an intern in the University of New Mexico in the IHS pathway. And I told her that I started a scholarship program there on the reservation after one of our hospital workers died of colon cancer before we did screening, and we raised $15,000 to $20,000 to give scholarships so students could finish their undergraduate training in radiation technology or whatever. And she says, oh, he was my uncle, but I never met him because he died 6 months before I was born. Then she went back to the reservation, looked up her birth certificate, and I delivered her. So to your point earlier, that was really satisfying for me. I love to tell that story. We had the first doctor from the Pima tribe graduate and join our faculty this year, Charity Bishop. So it's really gratifying to see especially young women making their way into family medicine from their tribes. Neil?
Neil Paul Fox, lead question guy. So thank you very much for showing us different models of how to approach these underserved populations. So my question is, you know, we're family medicine docs, and there seems to be a little bit of a antithesis with specialization. But over just this dialogue, I've heard about geographically underserved, rurally underserved, diversity, culturally underserved, First Nations underserved, and we seem to have, as family medicine, as an organization, then specialized in rural, global, diversity. And so my question is, from a appreciative inquiry, which I learned in the last, you know, as an organization, is that a good thing? Because there's a lot of overlap. And are we fighting with each other over, you know, who's the boss in rural and global health and so forth? Or is it to our advantage to really talk more broadly, especially when I look at the stats of who actually ends up where with these pipelines? So again, it's, are we specializing in underservedness and then creating programs which may be an advantage or necessary, or is it actually hurting us? That's the question.
Ivan, do you want to?
Yeah, I guess this might be a little heretical, but I think if anything, we've kind of despecialized, and we're having to kind of reinvent this notion of specializing in diversity and rural health. I mean, what got me into rural medicine was that we did everything and took care of everybody. And it just seems like there's been, like you said, a push to really kind of compartmentalize everything we do. Certainly we see it in terms of our training, where, you know, well, if you want to do inpatient care, you got to be a hospitalist. You know, if you want to do surgery, you need to just go and be a surgeon, you know. If you want to do outpatient procedures, you know, there's economic and educational forces that push people away from doing that. So I kind of not necessarily see it as something special, that we're specializing, just that we're kind of having to name it something to come back to do what, you know, what we should have been doing the whole time. It's just mine.
Yeah, I'd say I think our hearts are speaking rather than our minds when we focus on these areas, because our hearts go out to people that are suffering more, and we see that in rural, underserved, underrepresented minority, immigrant, refugee communities that we focus on. And I don't see the rest of the population suffering that much, so they're going to get taken care of anyhow. if we don't put our emphasis there. And to be frank, that's where most of our graduates go. They don't go to the rural underserved and other communities that we're reaching out to.
Make your questions and answers quickly.
Quickly. Okay. Shayla Serpas, Chula Vista. Something you said struck me, a chord similar to our recruitment process of finding a good fit for the program and the community and hoping that people will stay long-term in underserved communities. You mentioned how sometimes when individuals come from those communities, the idea of staying there is not always consistent. And I have seen that, and particularly family members who have this idea of success as being that Ivory Castle or getting out of the community and that conflicting feeling. So I'm just wondering if you have more kind of reflections from your experiences on that.
Well, I think the most effective way to get people into rural areas is just take students from rural areas. So reaching out to help with their educational attainment early on so they can be competitive in college and get into medical school is really important. There's a feminization of the workforce. My experience is that women would much rather be near their families than men would because they have children and they want their mothers to help out. And they want to be near their sisters and the rest of their extended family. So I think it's even more important to reach out to grow your own from the seeds of success in those communities and nurture them along the educational pathway, which starts probably at the first prenatal visit, but certainly in elementary and middle and high school. So we reach out to every high school in New Mexico to build a bridge to this pathway for medical education.
Quick question. Marian, this is just an amazing presentation, and I want to take everything home with me. My question actually does have to do with pipeline and that tracking and that as you start in high school or middle school. Besides sort of a statistical spreadsheet tracking and such, do you have touch points along the way where you're keeping in touch with those students through their journey or their undergraduate journey, et cetera, to really do good tracking and such?
Yeah, so the Doctors Academy program that I briefly touched on, so they have obviously various points throughout the high school contact that they meet with them, but they routinely connect with them at least once or twice a year. They're invited back as Doctors alumni, you know, Doctors Academy alumni, to come and talk to students like from their own school. So they not only kind of keep in touch with them by kind of surveying them and calling them, but also by inviting them back to continue to participate in the process so that the kids from these underserved schools can say, hey, look, this person went to my school. I can do that.
Yes, and this is a list of everybody who finished the IHS residency. It's 49 long, including the three people finishing this year. So we keep touch, and Warren Heffern is doing this for our entire residency. So, yeah, I think that's a really important point. So we use our alumni network to do that, too. Very similar to what Ivan said.
Thanks, guys.
next, I'd like to invite the panel, Dr. Prislin, Hickson, McKenna, to talk about reflections on choosing family medicine as a specialty.
So about a week and a half, 10 days ago, I got an email from Bill. And he said, so are you going to be there on Thursday morning? And I said, you know, stupid me. I said, yeah, I'll be there Thursday morning. There's nothing more challenging than being at the tail end of a conference. So we appreciate that all of you are still here with us. And as you can see, we're going to give the most important presentation of the conference. So by way of disclosure, well, do we have anything to disclose?
No.
No disclosures. Okay, here we go. Let's see. Nope, that wasn't it.
Turn that again. That's the off button.
Okay.
Okay, in that side.
This side. Got it. All right, so we are, after all, in Hawaii, and we want to follow the traditions of Hawaii. So the first part of our presentation is going to be one of oral narratives. Marianne, do you want to start us off?
Sure. Thank you all. And I realized after hearing these beautiful stories this morning, the presentations from Ohio, that just the presentation that just ended, it made me rethink a little bit. Is this not working?
Move it closer to you.
Oh, move it closer. Is this better? Okay, thanks. It made me think a little bit differently about my own journey and how some of these creative initiatives that are were presented today in certain ways in my own career 30 years ago probably influenced my journey into family medicine. So I'll try to highlight that and in a way endorse some of these fantastic programs that we heard about this morning. So similarly, I heard from Bill, and at first I thought, oh, I hope this doesn't mean it's an end of my career reflection, and so I'm just going to give a disclaimer that it's not, even though I've had the privilege of being an active family physician and teacher for 30 years. And probably like many of us, my story is one of caring about people, maybe not quite knowing the pathway right at the beginning. A series of opportunities that were presented and I was lucky to be involved in. And then mentorship. I won't go back to my candy striper days. I know somebody mentioned that yesterday, but I did have that as well. And graduated from college in 1976 and really wasn't quite sure what direction I was gonna go. Thought about public health, I thought about physical therapy, I just wasn't sure. I had grown up in a family really without any physicians and was told, you know, if you're, you know, you're a girl and you might want to have a family and really being a doctor might not work in that pathway. So I actually worked in a lab at the Salk Institute. I started volunteering at the Beach Area Community Clinic, which was a free clinic in the beach area of San Diego, and their mission statement was healthcare is a right, not a privilege. And I thought, okay, you know, I'm starting to feel that I'm maybe with my people. And I was volunteering in the women's clinic, doing pregnancy testing, talking with women about their health, and thought, you know, I'm going to give this a try. I'm going to, you know, take the MCATs and apply to medical school. And I was fortunate enough to get into UCI School of Medicine. And I thought I was going in with family medicine as my path, although OB did tempt me at certain moments. And after the first quarter of a pretty traditional med school curriculum, I thought, okay, this is fine, but I need to find something more. And I thought about volunteering. I was going to go find a community clinic in Orange County and volunteer. And then I got, again, one of these initiatives. I got a flyer in my mailbox from Mary Elizabeth Roth, who probably some of you know, pretty strong-minded family physician woman faculty, who was going to try a pilot project where you could apply and be connected with a family medicine resident in a community clinic and start your longitudinal experience. And I did just that and had almost a three-year experience in the community clinic of Orange County, which was just a beautiful experience. It was right in the immigrant neighborhood of Santa Ana at that time, Tacos Uruapan across the street and Pho, you know, down the next block, and just a great mix of patients. And I still remember my resident mentors, Debbie Satterfield, Tom Bent, and Louis LaLuce, who were very active at that time. And then I went on to UCSD for residency. And there I came across Bill Norcross as my program director. And, you know, he really exhibited the fact that you needed to be smart to be in family medicine. Intellectual integrity was very important. And he really emphasized counterculture, too. He loved our group of the communist counterculture, as he called us. And I realized that, you know, again, this was probably a Song Brown initiative or something that led us in our second year of residency to have a continuity clinic at the Santa Cedar Health Center. And there I came across Louis LaLuce again. He had gone there from residency. And anyway,
these initiatives, you know, kept, you know, community medicine alive. It kept my love of family medicine alive. And then really has come full circle in my career in being able to, you know, work again with San Ysidro and UCSD and our local community partners to establish the residency program and to be able to be there, you know, with such fantastic colleagues and these long-term relationships with patients. I've really been fortunate, I think, to continue to practice a very full spectrum of family medicine, inpatient, OB, longitudinal care. It's really beautiful, and I, just thinking back a little bit, just two more brief comments, I was thinking back to yesterday, how fortunate I was to be attending a state school. I think Dr. Don Frey said yesterday, you know, look at how the cost, the price of education has changed. I spent $600 a year in fees to go to medical school and, you know, had a little bit of debt for living and pay that off as a resident, you know. And I think that gave me a lot of freedom of choice of where to practice. I've actually have been employed my entire medical career, and I know some people are lamenting that direction, but again, I actually feel like it gave me some choices financially. My expectations remained, I think, reasonable. And lastly, we meet every year these amazing students. You heard them described earlier today that are, you know, dedicated to patients in the community. They're coming into our residency program and being trained, you know, both in the community aspect, but also in a very broad spectrum of family medicine. And just one concern that comes up, and this was discussed at our program directors meeting in Kansas City last weekend, is are we training our young physicians, our young family physicians, for careers that they might not be able to find? And that does sadden me, especially reflecting on what a marvelous experience, you know, and fulfilling experience my own career has been. So, thank you.
Chip?
Yeah, that's a beautiful story. Thank you. So Bill asked us to reflect a little bit on our personal journey, and you know, so it becomes sort of an N equals one experiment, and I hope there'll be some lessons and applicability we can draw from it. So I thought for my first slide I'd use a high school yearbook picture. No, I'm just kidding. I won't do that to you. So. I consider myself an accidental doctor, and what I mean by that is I didn't have any doctors in the family. It never occurred to me to be a doctor, and I sort of just went on my way. I was mostly interested in playing jazz drums, and I thought that was probably the future. And you know, it's always good to be a musician in case this medical thing doesn't work out. You know, you gotta have something. So I found my way eventually into college, and I studied anthropology, and you know, anthropology is really about human systems, and it's about communities, it's about understanding family structures, and you know, I didn't know it at the time, but I was actually preparing myself to be a family physician. And after college, I had some chances to sort of apply that anthropology, and I began to do some international work, and I worked with somebody mentioned the Ugly American book that had come out. And there was a cross-cultural training agency called the Business Council for International Understanding, and it was in Washington, D.C., American University, and I spent a few years actually putting training programs together for American business interests that were working all overseas in terms of language and cultural orientation and so on. So in that work, I started traveling all over the place, and you just start to realize what an incredible, wonderful, big world this is. And one thing led to another, and I got a graduate degree in international development, which is really truly the study of poverty and the alleviation of poverty and international organizations and how they interact towards that mission. So one thing leads to another, and I found myself in Southeast Asian refugee camps, really the last chapter of the Vietnam War, and this huge diaspora with movement of Lao and Vietnamese and Khmer folks to the United States. And this was a fairly misguided State Department program that I was part of, trying to get folks ready for this move to this large immigration. So it was in some of these sort of camp settings on the Thai-Cambodian border in the Philippines and so on, and you see thousands of people, and it sort of works you over, and I sort of thought, gee, maybe I need some different, you know, tools in the kit. And this, you know, interesting thing, I think, about how life unfolds is that there are these just unexpected experiences. So it turns out that there was a family medicine resident in that refugee camp with her husband, and they were working there for a year. And she was from Brown, and their program director had let her go for a year, and then she was going to go back and finish her final year of family medicine training. And I said to her, gee, you know, how wonderful that you have, you know, these tools and that you can do this amazing, you know, work helping and serving people. And she's very matter of fact, she just looked at me and said, why don't you do it? And that interaction, you know, the other side of the world, really put something in my face. And I had never taken a science course in college. And I left the refugee camps, came back to the States, and put myself into night school and found my way into medical school. So I really think I am a sort of an accidental doctor in that way. And then if you enter medical school in this manner, the manner I did, family medicine is just obvious. You don't really need to be a pediatric cardiologist in the middle of a refugee camp or whatever. And so all of the principles of family medicine just really made sense to me. And I have some, I've had some very important mentors along the way. And, you know, I think, you know, all of us have, and I really just want to call out Perry Puno, who I met when I had my residency training in Sacramento many years ago. And, you know, Perry pushed me in a lot of different directions, and I ended up getting involved at the academy level and so on. And none of those things would have happened without Perry. And I know Perry's mentored many of you in this room, I'm certain, and has, you know, been a guiding light for a lot of us. But Perry, I just want to thank you, and I, you know, have had some other mentors along the way, and, you know, maybe we don't take enough time to thank the people whose shoulders we stand upon. So I just want to say thank you, Perry, for all you've done for me and many others over the years. So I do have some enduring wisdom sort of reflections on maybe what all of this means and why people would choose family medicine as a career, but I think I'd like to hold them aside, and we'll let Mike tell his story, and we'll get back to them at the end.
So my journey is doesn't rank with theirs. It's very simple. I was a biology major, and as a biology major at a University of California campus, there's really three options. You can teach somewhere K through 12. You can go on and get a PhD and do research, or you can go to medical school. And so I looked at those options and I thought, you know, gee, I just went through junior high school and high school. I don't want to do that again. I spent some time working in a research lab, and I realized quickly that I didn't have the patience to have 20-year outcomes, so that left medical school. Once I got to medical school, a light came on and there was a golden epiphany, only it wasn't the kind of epiphany that you hear about in family medicine. My epiphany was, I love internal medicine and adults, but I don't want to spend all day taking care of chronic disease. And children are wonderful, but I want to have some adult conversations. And I loved OBGYN, but I didn't want to perform one operation on the gynecologic side as a major component of my career. Psychiatry was good, except for psychotic people made me nervous. Surgery, I had two thumbs, so that was something to overcome. So that left family medicine. And so what I would like to do, because this is, after all, the conference on access to primary care, is rather, I'm gonna take the liberty of changing the agenda, and we're in family medicine, so I wanna spend a couple minutes talking about the hidden agenda, which is, why aren't we getting more, and I'm, with apologies to my osteopathic colleagues, we're gonna talk about allopathic schools for a couple minutes. And the reason we're gonna talk about allopathic schools is this just came out this week. One of my favorite sources, U.S. News, or what used to be U.S. News and World Report. These are the health sciences campuses that train the most graduates for primary care residencies. And I would point out to you, these are the top 10 nationally, and 8 of the top 10 are osteopathic institutions. So I think what we've got here, and I'm hoping that there'll be some dialogue, is that we've got an allopathic problem. I don't know that we have an osteopathic problem. This has nothing to do with the talk. I just love this picture. I would comment, though, that this may be the last time that our country was really unified. And as Neil pointed out yesterday, the oceans are getting warmer, and we better figure out a way, if we're talking about global health challenges, we better figure out a way to get unified again so that we can deal with that. Okay, we won. We're in 124 of 134 allopathic schools. And that this is from the AAFP. If you've got their little bulletin on match day, they said, you know, it marks a decade of growth for family medicine. Way to go. I looked on the internet for a cartoon describing a pyrrhic victory, and I got this from the 2016 primary campaign. I think it's a wonderful shot. So here's the problem. I mean, here's the problem. I think we live in a reductionist world. This is our match data from UCI, and I picked emergency medicine because emergency medicine along with family medicine are two of the more recent specialties approved in the latter half of the 20th century. And you may ask me a bit later why there's a couple anomalous years where family medicine did reasonably well. But, you know, we have a class size of about 100, give or take. 19 students out of 100 going into emergency medicine. All right, so here's the detail. Family medicine, our fill rate overall was 93%, which was, if you don't count preliminary positions, we were pretty much the lowest. Our allopathic fill rate was 39%. If you look at emergency medicine, they filled at 98.8%, and allopathic fill rate was about 65%. So why do students do what they do? I think the first thing is scope of practice. I mean, we all like to do what we enjoy doing and what we're good at. People that like to work with their hands and are good at it, they choose surgery. I still think, and I've spent a lot of time over the years talking to students, that students choose specialties based on where their interests and their aptitudes lie. I think there's a big piece of pragmatism, and we'll come back to that in a moment. And then I think the final component is, you know, for lack of a better word, I would call it evangelism. And that's where critical experiences, role models, mentors come into play. So let's just compare family medicine to emergency medicine here. And I've got some things that I think are in terms of scope of practice. We've got some things in terms of the pragmatism. And so, you know, our specialties are similar in a lot of ways. The one big difference, of course, is that there's no continuity in emergency medicine, although some of my colleagues would argue about that in terms of a lot of return visits when it's your court of last resort. But you look at what's going on, and this is from Medscape surveys. I mean, if you're me and you're looking at scope of practice, well, gee, only 2/3 of our graduates are doing pediatrics now. Only 10% are doing obstetrics. The number of procedures that family physicians do has dwindled considerably. Look at the work hours. Now, 51 hours, we were talking about this morning, you know, back when things were tough and we all worked 110 hours a week in our residencies, it wasn't so bad, so 51 hours is pretty easy. But look at our colleagues in emergency medicine. That's the average work week is 32 hours a week. Look at the salary discrepancy. And then we had the information in terms of, and I thought this was interesting, in talking about being happy at work, being happy outside of work, and the burnout numbers. So the question is, where do we go from here? Chip, you have some thoughts. he's gonna answer all of our questions,
so,
by the way.
So I worried about this talk a lot, and because I know that lots of folks have spent 30 years trying to figure out how to, you know, kind of corral more people into family medicine, and there have been MACI reports and Robert Graham Center articles and all sorts of things, and I thought, you know, I needed to have the answer this morning on the stage, and so that worried me a little bit. But fortunately, you know, at breakfast I reread the title, and the title is Reflections. It's not Solutions, it's Reflections. So I think we can reflect, and maybe I'd be a little bit off the hook for having the answer. So here are a couple reflections, and you know, hopefully we can get some dialogue. So the first, we heard this morning about how important strategy is, and that's really true. And strategy has to be driven by core values. And I think the challenge for us right now is that the environment's changing very rapidly. We need to be nimble. We need to be able to change and adapt. But we also need to hang on dearly to our core values and to know what those are. And to me, generalism is powerful, and it's not always maybe welcome or recognized in this sort of medical hierarchy, but it's really powerful, and it's a bit of our secret sauce, and we can't let that go. So that generalism, that way of thinking broadly, is so important. And if you look at leadership, the folks who really have the ability to be tremendous leaders very often come from these generalist backgrounds. And you know, may also have studied humanities and other things. I'm thinking of Sam, who we talked with last night, who was telling me about comparative literature and other things that, you know, really give you a base from which to operate. So I think our specialty has to really hang on to the generalism piece. I think being authentic is essential, and I look at this person sitting next to me and the work that she's done for 30 years, and who I've just met at this conference, and I think that any student or resident that spent time with their clinic on the border would say, this is authentic, this is the real work, and a certain subset of students are going to be drawn immediately to that, and it's that authenticity of delivering the goods where they're needed that we really need to hang on to. I would say that counterculture is not only just okay, it's necessary. And it's necessary because the health system doesn't have it right yet. And counterculture is about new ways of looking at things and being willing to take some risks and make change. So counterculture, which is part of our sort of birthright, I think, in family medicine, we can't just let that go. I'd also say that there's an intergenerational thing going on right now. And I don't completely understand it, but as I'm hiring new faculty members and so forth, I'm really seeing that there's a very, very different approach to work-life balance and other things. And it's you know, easy to say that we, you know, walked through 8 feet of snow to get to work or whatever it was, and it was different back then. And it's actually very important that we strip some of that away and try to understand what's going on intergenerationally and how we can learn from the new generations coming behind, because they have a lot to teach us, and they're going to have to figure out some of this. Along with the intergenerational piece is a communication change that's very profound, and it has a lot to do with cell phones and tweets and texts. And, you know, I remember the first time I was on OB call, and, you know, I got up in the morning and found out a baby had been delivered, and the intern said, well, I sent you 10. You know, I guess that meant, you know, 10 centimeters, and I was supposed to get out of bed and drive to the hospital, you know. And so, again, obviously there's a little communication divide there, and I, you know, trying to get with it. But I'm joking a little bit, but I think that we do have to understand how patterns of communication are changing. And if we think of ourselves as professional communicators, which as family doctors we're supposed to both sort of listen with two ears and talk with one mouth, we need to get around this. And the last is really around this leadership advocacy. And I mentioned it earlier that generalism, counterculture, and some of these pieces really put us in a position where we should be providing tremendous leadership to the, quite damaged healthcare system that we live in, and I hope we can continue to do that. So those are reflections. So a couple of examples of things that I think work. And then I'm trying to not take all the time. So at the University of Hawaii, we have something called an Imiho'ola program, which takes young people from underserved backgrounds who might not easily get into medical school, and it gives them an additional year of training where they're pre-accepted into medical school, and then they come for a year and they get a lot of hard science and kind of a leg up so that when they start the next year, they're really ready to go. And it's produced some tremendous individuals and leaders in our state, in the medical profession, and it's been a wonderful pathway for folks that might not have made it to medical school otherwise. So those, and I know many of you have those sorts of programs, we need to think about how to expand those. Another one to keep an eye on is Jeff Borkin's program at Brown. It's very interesting, where they've created a master's degree in primary care and population health, and they've enrolled a third of their class in this program, and it's now, I think, graduated its first class, and they've generated a lot of general surgeons and primary care docs, and that's a program to watch. And the thing that's innovative about it is not just that you get a master's degree, and I think lots of us have tracks and certificates and this and that, but it's that this is not a little tweak around the edge. This is saying a third of our folks are going to be sent this direction. And that's very significant in medical education. And so I think we got to start to think, what are those sort of bold steps? So I think these are examples of the programs that, we should start to look to and see if we can grow them and then how they can help us. But I guess I'd just like to go back to our core values of generalism, being authentic in the way we address needs wherever they may be, and I think that those elements are certainly will continue to be attractive to students.
In some ways, this session might have been better placed if it was the first session of the day today, because I think a lot of the other sessions provided some of the answers. I have a couple thoughts. One of them is, I mentioned the scope of practice is changing and has changed. And quite honestly, I'm not sure that the territory that's been lost by family medicine is ever going to be regained. So I think there's something else we can do, though, and that's redefine what a family physician is and what scope of practice is. And I heard a lot of that this morning. And again, reaching out to vulnerable and underserved populations, that's a scope of practice. I think addressing important issues of global health, that's a scope of practice. That's something that we can, as we start to redefine family medicine, we can think about. I think about advocacy and being the group that advocates for a variety of populations, I think is important. I think thinking about how we can, I'm not sure what to think about artificial intelligence, but I do think that we better get on that bandwagon and have some input in terms of how that's going to be deployed so that it becomes a tool that is useful rather than a tool that drives us. So I think there's lots of opportunities, but I think we need to rethink about what it is to be a family physician and what the content might be. And then I think that, I didn't talk about evangelism. I left that there because I think my colleagues talked about it pretty well. I think that's key. And that's part of that process of being there and being heard. And I see that I have a colleague over there who wants to give me a wedgie. So I did not mention mentorship, but I would like to close this by really recognizing four individuals that have been critical to this conference, and personally, really, really, really critical to my career development. And I'm going to start with Nancy and Bill, and we've heard what they've done with the conference, but for me personally, they've been friends through the years. I came to California and was confronted immediately with the prospect of having to face the Song Brown Commission. And starting with that and many other things, Bill helped me navigate my way through that. And as a consequence, became a trusted friend and advisor for a lot of other issues. And actually, I had the good fortune of him spending some time with me while I was chair at UC Irvine. The second person, unfortunately, he just left, but John Guymon, for me personally, I ran into him when I was a second year resident in Portland, and he was down visiting our program. And this big, powerful chair of the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Washington took the time to sit down with a lowly second-year family medicine resident. And our paths crossed many times over the year, and John was always patient and provided a lot of really, really pragmatic, practical, and useful advice to me. And the third person that I'd like to recognize is Jack Rodnick. Jack was a active participant in this conference series, and you know, it's fitting, he had a special place in his heart for Kauai. He and Judy and their family had a place up on the north shore of Kauai. They loved coming here, they loved coming to the conference. Jack embraced life and embraced family medicine. He was, I think, for many of us in California, a tremendous mentor and role model. And I know for me personally, I miss him desperately. And, you know, having this conference end here and thinking of Jack is particularly special.
Thank you. We have time for one question, Don.
Don Fry from Omaha. It's always occurred to me that if we were serious about increasing the number of family physicians, in reference to what you said, Michael, we would not open a single additional allopathic medical school or medical school slot. We would only open osteopathic schools because they're the ones who are producing the family physicians. I say that at Creighton. The judges don't appreciate it, but I continue to say it. The other point is, we're dealing with a public perception issue that goes way back, and it hits our applicants way before they come to medical school, way before when they're kids. And here's how I'll illustrate it. I'm going to ask you how you would deal with this. There used to be a program for the younger people in the room called the Beverly Hillbillies. It was one of the dumbest programs ever on television. And in the Beverly Hillbillies, there was a recurrent recycled joke that went like this. Jethro, who was 17 years old and in the sixth grade at Beverly Hills High School, grade school, would come home and he would make some brilliant observation like 2 + 2 = 4. In which case, his Uncle Jed would say, "Hey, doggies, that boy's getting smarter every day." And then Jethro, beaming, would say, "Yeah, Uncle Jed, when I grow up, I'm going to be a brain surgeon." And the audience would erupt with laughter. I often wonder what would happen if Jethro had said, "Yeah, Uncle Jed, when I grow up, I want to be a board-certified family physician, and I want to go back to Possum Trot, Tennessee, and take care of all those poor folks back there." Would there have been as much laughter? Would there have been any laughter? Would people have said, "Yeah, well, probably Jethro can do that"? That's a public perception that's deeply ingrained. How do we counteract that? How do we fight that?
Could I piggyback on that question?
Yeah. Go for it.
Go for it. So, this is a little more, I'm sorry, Alan Wilkie, Kalamazoo. If I'm a medical student and family medicine hasn't already chosen me, the question I'm going to be asking myself is, what's in it for me?
Your question is easier, I think, than the first question, at least in my mind. I may be simplistic, but you know, again, maybe we have something to learn from our osteopathic colleagues. I'd have to sit down and talk, but I would question if we really want to be training more family physicians, then we need to get a different group of people coming to medical school. And, you know, and I think that was so beautifully demonstrated in the first presentation this morning. Public perception is a really complicated thing. And, you know, my other take on public perception is watch the nightly news and don't pay any attention to news, but pay attention to the commercials and see what is being marketed. And it's Keytruda and a variety of other things, which is how contemporary medicine is being presented to our public. And when they do have medical stories on the nightly news, you know, they're not about, you know, how people went in and saved a community. They're about, you know, new data out on the utilization of XYZ technology to treat, you know, disease number four. And so if we're going to go about changing that, you know, then again, it's be there, be heard, but then we've got to get into those channels of communication. I think a lot of what needs to happen is very different than what any of us are trained to do. So maybe one of the answers there is that we need to find some strategic alliances with folks that are not clinicians, but work well in other worlds of communication, and then start to figure out different ways to get messages out to the public.
Thank you. I think we need to substitute Marcus Welby for Grey's Anatomy, personally. So I'd like to invite Dr. Flinders, Pugno, and Babbitts up to reflect on this conference before it closes. No, and everyone has to stay.
Good morning.
You forgot your shoes. You forgot your shoes.
No, I didn't. I freeze in my shoes. I got sandals on. So I brought my wool socks, my mountain socks. Good morning. This should be brief. I've got only 10 slides. And provided I can maintain the manual dexterity necessary to actually change a slide, this should take under 10 minutes. This talk could also be titled Loose Ends and Enduring Questions. This morning, I want to reflect on some further contributions to our enduring wisdom, make a single point on the central issue of our current health reform debate, and revisit a lead question by one of our conference speakers, and then close with a poem of 17 syllables. First, though, I want to thank Neil Palafox for yesterday's Gail Stevens lecture. It was inspiring. It was courageous, and no one would have enjoyed it more than Gail Stevens himself. I pushed it.
Right side.
Not again. All right, this guy gets mentioned anytime wisdom is brought up in this group. We're talking about the road ahead and what lies ahead, what his family medicine should become. This is from 2014 on the release of the Family Medicine Future document. If you want to know what should be the direction of family medicine in the 21st century, go back and read what we wrote in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. Now things change, but much wisdom endures, and that's why we're here. Here's more enduring wisdom. Don't give up on the reform ethos and keep on the side of responsible change in education, practice, and social justice. What is the next step? Don McCann, one of the pioneers for the campaign in support of single payer, past president of PNHP, couldn't make it this year. He had health issues. And so I asked him if there's anything he wanted me to say. He gave me about 6 paragraphs. But it could be summarized in this one sentence: beware of fake single payer. Now the gentleman here on the left is not Don McCann, but he could be.
in fact, is kind of a twin when it comes to being an assiduous, relentless reformer campaigner for single payer. This is the point that I want to make. This is the overhead per capita, per year per enrollee of private Medicare Advantage plans versus traditional Medicare. You see the difference? For traditional Medicare, it's $147 annually per enrollee. Is it any more expensive for privately financed Medicare? Yeah, about 1,000% more. It's $1,400. Now, Kevin, fortunately, is gone. And he is involved deeply in the Medicare Advantage programs. I belong to Medicare Advantage through Kaiser. I get free gym because of the Silver Sneaker program. And I'm doing well. But the taxpayer dollars that are paying for that care are unfair to everyone else. So when we talk about single payer, we spent 30 years trying to advance the cause and concept of single payer, and we finally got it into the public dialogue. After more work, we finally settled on a common vocabulary that many people understand: Medicare for all. It's simple. But now, as in most movements, the opposition has caught up and co-opted our own language, confusing the public as well as Congress with a myriad of counterfeit proposals under the name of Medicare for All, Medicare X, public option, et cetera, et cetera. Most of these are nothing more than Trojan horses from the private insurance industry. Same corporate greed, same massive waste under a different name. There are currently 9 bills before Congress bearing variations on the name of Medicare for All. 7 of these are imposters. 2 are the real deal. Saunders' bill in the Senate and Jayapal's bill in the House, for example, provide true Medicare administrative efficiency, universal coverage, bulk purchasing, and negotiated prices for drugs. Our current and most urgent issue is to educate the public and our legislators and the policymakers the difference between true single payer with all the benefits of traditional Medicare for all and the profiteering imposters who are exploiting through false labeling legislative proposals called Medicare for All. How's my time?
You're good.
All right. In my last year of work before I retired, I spent a lot of time in the archives and interviews and stuff that I'd learned from Gail Stevens, and I wrote commentaries on 5 of his most enduring essays. These are the 5 that are included. And I just want to make a comment on two of them. Parable of the Big Red Bull. We know what it is. It's the medical industrial complex. But it's not just about high-tech medicine. It's also about another kind of breed, low-tech or personal medicine. It's a commitment in which one human being encounters another human being in dialogue, in sincere conversation, and takes personal responsibility for their care. It's a labor-intensive, non-procedural relationship in caring. It includes diagnosing, prescribing, repairing, informing, advising, educating, and advocating. It's a partnership. Above all, it is personal. And most of all, it requires listening. Now, after my talk on Monday, James Herman asked the question, Rick, all this thing about listening, about being present, engaged in the present moment, how do you pass that along? How do you teach that? How do you instruct it? It ain't easy, and I wasn't being flip by saying it's sort of the Zen moment, learning to be in the here and now, which isn't something you do, you know, with a pill or a drug or a one night or 1 week retreat. I've been meditating for 50 years, and I'm still working at it. When I spoke with Gail, I realized he had a reflective practice as well, a personal reflective practice. And whatever you do, the importance is being able to be there with the patient. Now, how do you do it? You got to find your own way. But let me just give you a description of Gail's experience of it. In a 1992 interview with Lucy Candib, did she ever come here? Was Lucy ever at this conference? Siaskale, when you say engaged in your work, I take it you mean seeing patients. His reply, seeing patients, that's the words, that's the work. Everything else is tangential to that. I've never been bored by or disliked or dreaded seeing patients. Seeing patients is always a new excitement to me, every day. I think about it every morning when I get up. I never put my hand on the door of an examination room that I don't feel some kind of new surge of wonder, perhaps even reverence. There is a sense in which you need to clear your head and purify your thoughts before you go in to see a new patient. That whole experience is multipotentiality. As soon as you open your mouth, you limit it in some way. Something less is possible as soon as you say hello. That's why it's reverent. You'd like to go in there and not limit the possibility of what can happen. Now, it may turn out to be a purely routine and mundane visit, at least the occasion for it, but the patient is never routine or mundane. I find it the most exciting human activity there could possibly be. I would pay to do it. And one last, from William Carlos Williams, another respected voice in American medicine. He writes of the same experience. So for me, the practice of medicine has become the pursuit of a rare element, which may appear at any time, any place, at a glance. When the patient struggles to lay him herself or herself before you, we catch a glimpse of something from time to time, which shows us that a presence has just brushed past us, some rare thing, and for a moment, we are dazzled. The relationship between physician and patient, if literally followed, leads to experience which we barely deserve. But it's there. It's magnificent. It fills my thoughts and reaches to the furthest limits of our lives. Okay, and one last piece of wondering wisdom. This one from Mac. Sometimes, he said this, I think I first heard it in 2016, it is the duty of a reformed generation not to implement radical change, but to keep the flame of social reform alive. And finally, some of you know, some of you don't, I retired last year after 40 years in the same job, which I feel absolutely privileged and fortunate to have done. I love my work, I still do, but I love what I'm doing now. So, as a parting shot, in the ancient Zen tradition, before retiring from the world, a teacher was expected to compose a final poem in haiku form that summarized the wisdom, if any, he or she had gained in their lifetime, and it was called the terminal haiku. All right, haiku rules, 3 lines, 17 syllables, 5, 7, and 5. So, medicines like love. Keep it personal. Make it for everyone. Thank you.
God, what a hard act to follow. I have no slides. It's called reflections. That translates to pontifications at this point. But I have some thoughts, and this was the title says Reflections on This Conference, but I think that a lot of what I'm about to say really applies to the 30 years of conferences. And I've been blessed to be involved with a lot of them. In fact, I've been blessed on many levels to spend time with people like Gail Stevens. I remember John Guyman when he came to Davis as junior faculty. I was a med student and remember him coming to campus. So the first observation I have, and I've mentioned this to several people, is one of the real blessings of this series is our capacity for civil discourse. We've mentioned it some. To see John Guyman and David Sunwall at the same table, to listen to Josh Freeman and not beat him up, and to really realize that the people here, we've all drunk the Kool-Aid, but we're not all family physicians. This is a diverse group. We have our behaviorists, we have educationalists, we have finance people, we have a general surgeon who's speaking in favor of what we're doing. We have a diversity of perspectives, an extraordinarily broad diversity of perspectives. And yet, we've had a civil discourse. We've been able to articulate the common ground. We've been able to share different perspectives that provide us a wealth of opportunities. And I think that's been one of the key strengths of this conference and one of the things I will miss the most. The second is that we've had the courage to call a spade and to raise issues that we know are there. We need to acknowledge them. We know they're a problem, and we need to deal with it. And there are things like the hidden curriculum, the profiteering, and how much money has been sucked out of the healthcare system that would go to patient care but has gone to profit centers and investors and people like that. And that intellectual honesty, I think, has been really important in these meetings. The third point is that if you look at all of these presentations, it's like 4 days of TED Talks, and here we've got 30 years of it. There is an extreme amount of good work that has been reported at these meetings. There's a lot of people who've been laboring in the fields for a long time and have worked hard over an extended period of time, and an extraordinary amount of good work has been done in family medicine, for family medicine, but more importantly for the people we serve in family medicine, the general public. And an awful lot of that good work has been heard here and maybe nowhere else, which I think is a tragedy. And I think the real, one of the blessings of the Coastal Research Group is that Bill has been capturing this information on the website, transcribing it, and there is a rich resource of good information that has been generated over these 30 years. And I think that's a resource that some of us are working really hard to try to make sure gets preserved. we've talked about enduring wisdom at this meeting. But that enduring wisdom and things that Gail Stevens and others have said over time, that enduring wisdom is alive and well. I think we've had the honesty to admit that it's evolving, but there are still core components to it that we all embrace, believe, live, and breathe every day. And that feels really good. And this meeting in particular, we've talked a lot about culture. And, you know, family medicine was called a counterculture, but it is a culture. And we, in this room, despite our diversity and varying viewpoints, we all have embraced that culture. And to the extent that the people in this room and many who haven't been able to come to these meetings but are out there laboring in the fields, they have also embraced that culture, and they show it through the love and the work that they provide to our trainees, to our patients, to our constituents, to our communities over time. I believe that the students who matter see that, they embrace it, and will carry the torch forward. And although there's a handful of us old timers at this meeting, there's a number of young folks who have drunk the Kool-Aid and have the energy to run forward, carrying the flame just as fast as they can. And it's one of the reasons I sleep well at night, is because I believe that family medicine is so important that the public will eventually wake up and recognize family medicine and what we offer for what it is. And that too is a blessing that I look forward to, and I'm blessed to have a family physician taking care of me and my family who has drunk the Kool-Aid, who is willing to talk to us and find out who we are as people, not just pieces of meat on an assembly line. family medicine is good for this nation, good for the world, as we've seen in our global health presentations. And this meeting has been has captured so many different aspects of the benefits of family medicine, and I have to say I am privileged to have been involved with it. Thanks.
Okay. Is there a doctor in the house?
I want a dramatic ending, but not like that. So my enduring wisdom is I get to reflect on my 29 years coming to this conference. So thank you, Bill and others. And so what I want to say probably is a summary of all the things that have brought me to this point. So I'm going to be reflecting on that. I want to talk about something about history, something about cliches, something about culture, something about emotional intelligence, something about being there, and then some thank yous. So the first thing, I'm thinking back to all the conferences. We started out with a concern about a shortage of primary care physicians and pay inequity. Have we solved that problem? No. We talked about the problem with federal funding and not going to primary care. I remember early conferences, we need to have an institute at NIH of primary care institute. Has that happened? No. We talked about the importance of preventive care and public health, which I'm in now, and how that is as important, or the slides have shown, more important than curative care. When you look at what affects the health of a population, it is not curative care. It is public health, preventive care, as well as genetics and other things in their environment. Have we solved that problem? No. And then comprehensive care. We've talked a lot about what it means to be family physician. Comprehensive care, being with the patient. Are we the primary providers in the nation? Are we the ones who are leading the course, who are, I don't know, making the most money, if you want to use that as the measure? I don't take that as the measure, but no. You know, it's our high-tech subspecialists, who I like to refer to as partialists, who are still leading the way in those areas. So we haven't done that. And our reimbursement systems in American healthcare just reinforce that system. So some of the problems we first heard talked about 29 years ago, so-so. So that's, is the cup half full or half empty? I think it's probably still more than half full. Some cliches that I want to sort of maybe heard before, but want to mention again, leave you with this. Remember that most of our subspecialty colleagues are partialists. They only take care of a little piece of a person. And when you remind patients of that, they kind of look at you and they say, oh yeah, that's why they wouldn't answer my question about X, Y, Z, because they're just my liver doctor, my stomach doctor, my knee doctor, et cetera, et cetera. Remember that there are two kinds of physicians. There are physicians who are just fascinated by the presence of illness that happens to occur in human beings. And all our partially colleagues would fall into that, in that area. And then there are physicians who care about people and their communities and where they live and their families. And when those people happen to suffer from maladies of one kind or another, whether it's environmental, emotional, psychological, physical, there are doctors who take care of them. Well, that's what we've heard a lot about at this meeting, and I believe that's who we are, and I'm very proud to be part of that group. Another little cliche kind of thing is, remember a little mantra I was taught years ago? Patients don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. I've demonstrated that in some of the talks this morning. I think it's real important to keep to remember. I wanted to mention something called emotional intelligence. How many know what emotional intelligence is? Most of you familiar with it? You want to talk about politics. You want to talk about changing systems. You have to understand emotional intelligence. How many times have you heard somebody say, I presented reams of facts to these people. I went to the legislature. I testified. I gave them all the data. And they still didn't vote my way. Because you're trying to use academic intelligence with other human beings who do not react to that. I read a book recently talked about emotional intelligence. It was a great analogy. They said emotional intelligence and academic intelligence is like a man riding an elephant through the jungle. The man on top who's driving is the academic intellectual intelligence. The elephant is the emotional intelligence. The man can direct the elephant along a path until one thing happens. The elephant sees his favorite food over there. And guess where they're going? That's emotional intelligence. I was at a hearing years ago, and I have the great pleasure of testifying at our state legislature in my current role, but I was at a hearing a few years ago where our Office of the Medical Examiner desperately needed to be able to hire at least one more pathologist to kind of catch up with the backload. And we had gingerly and delicately put in requests for money and had all the numbers and how many cases we had and how far we were back and what the national standard was. And the committee looked at that and, yeah, fine, yeah, and go to the, they're ready to go to the next thing until a senator stood up and said, let me tell you a story. I was on an airplane doing a, it was actually a medical mission he was part of, and he wasn't a physician, in Central America, and the plane crashed. And everybody on the plane except he and another woman perished. He and the woman were rescued. And he said, this woman was my neighbor, and we were on this medical mission together. And you know what really troubles me, he told the committee, is this woman had to wait 2 years for an autopsy report so she could get benefits from her husband's death on this plane crash. The committee voted to fund two pathologists immediately. That's emotional intelligence in action. So now when I'm counseling my staff in the health department, I say, if you're going to go present this, we call them building blocks, you want to present money to the state legislature, I want to hear the story you're going to tell them. Because I don't want to just hear all the facts. It's not going to work. So let's, if we want to make differences, understand the emotional intelligence. And a part of that is what you've heard over and over in this, and I love the theme, it's been here for 30 years, and was really emphasized this time, it's kind of the theme of being there and being reflective. There is no substitute. I told you the story of my patient who died of cancer and just wanted to hold my hand. Boy, did I learn the lesson that day. It's about being there. Nobody else can do that. You know, that's something we do, and we do it well. We need to emphasize that and emphasize that. And as we were reminded from Gail Stevens, to reflect on those things. I've had time, as I've had to become a teacher, other things, to reflect on my patient experiences, to learn what I, or to relearn what I learned from those things, being there. And last but not least, as the time runs late and everybody wants to go, it's always bad to be the last speaker. Well, actually, the question person is the last speaker. There's a lot of thank yous. So first of all, thank you to Bill and Nancy for 30 incredible years, 29 for me, for all the work. This is not an easy job. It's a lot of work to arrange all the things, put everything together. Nancy, thank you for coming in, because thank you to you too. I want to thank the many members who contributed to the wonderful gifts we were able to buy to Bill and Nancy. These were not inexpensive things that we got, but there actually was some money left over, and I gave Nancy a Visa gift card today for, with the rest of the funds that we had from our account. It might be enough to pay the freight to ship those things home, Bill. thank you to Bill and Nancy. I want to thank people who have come to this in the past. You know, there are a lot of folks that we think about. Jack Roddick was a good friend of mine. Marion Bishop, I became a good friend of her when I was working for her. A lot of people who came here in the past who we miss and we want to remember, and I want to thank them. Every one of us actually needs, should, wants to thank them. They are the people on whose shoulders we stand, as Chip said today. This is who made us who we are, and I'm grateful to them. But at the same time, I have equal gratitude for each one of you. It's been such a pleasure to know you. I mean, Chuck was my fellow in uniform for many years at these meetings, and meeting John and Alan. I mean, I could go through the names. John Boltry with his incredible leadership and vision and doing things the program. I mean, go right around the room and look at every one of you and say, thank you for what you do, and what a privilege for me to get to know you. And Neil, your incredible talk yesterday was just fabulous. And picking up on Neil's talk, I want to remind us, number one, we are voyagers. We are voyagers on a path of reforming health, one patient at a time, by being there. And whether the rest of the world accepts that or not, it doesn't make any difference. Because the voyage we're on is important to you, to me, and to that patient. And if people can't see that, I'm sad and I'm sorry, that doesn't change the value. We are voyagers and we're on a voyage. And again, to pick a little bit off of Neil's talk, I actually had to ask him this morning. I said, Neil, I'm just really curious, after hearing your talk, how did the Native Hawaiians react to the movie Moana? Disney does these movies, and sometimes they don't go over very well with the people in the country. My wife and I went to visit China last year, and we asked people, how did you like Mulan? They said, we loved it. I said, okay. So Neil gave me an interesting explanation. At first, he said the Hawaiians were very much resistant to the idea, but they sort of slowly warmed over time and came around to doing that. Well, there's a line in the one of the songs from there that the grandmother sings, know who you are. Be who you are. The ocean chose you to be a family physician. Be who you are. Be on that voyage. And again, I just want to express my gratitude. It's been a great privilege to be at these meetings and to get to know you and to appreciate what you do. Thank you.
Lee Burnett, Student Doctor Network. First off, gentlemen, thank you. What a fantastic way to close out these 30 years with what you just had. Rick, you spoke of the road ahead and enduring wisdom. In that vein, I'd like to turn this question really back to the audience. Do we want this 30th conference to be the end, to be the terminal haiku? Or would we like this wisdom to endure? So I'm curious, in show of hands, who would like to see a 31st national conference? It's unanimous. Thank you.
Awesome.
Nothing more to say.
I think that says it all.
I think that's the end.
Any other questions or comments? Bill?
Anybody dare and ask another question?
We're the only thing standing between them and a pina colada right now.
William Burnett from the Coastal Research Group. You have a question of me?
No, I was wondering if you wanted to make any comments. Or...
Well, I do think that these 30 years, which I did want to state, came out of the work that a number of us did on the National Advisory Council of the National Health Service Corps, where people like Mark Babbitts and Chuck North and others were so it was so important that we decided as the National Advisory Committee that we would counsel it, that we would go around the country to see all of the experiences that were taking place, and I think that that's what gave us the idea of doing this. These particular conferences obviously have taken more than we can, that Nancy and I can commit to in the future, but there are, but it's a body of knowledge that can be that can be transformed in appropriate ways into other mechanisms, including perhaps smaller conferences, certainly including the spectacular presence of the Student Doctor Network, the studentdoctor.net, and the other kinds of uses of media to get to students, that there are a number of different things, different ideas that we will have that will be calling upon you and that Lee Burnett and others will be connecting with you, Laura Turner and the like will be connecting with you in the future. So this need not be the end of the voyage. It might be tacking in different directions here and there, but I look forward to seeing whether there are people that would like to continue on this sorts of discourse and this sorts of activity, and look forward to see what happens. Thank you all.
Thank you. And thank you, everyone. Yes, 1 minute early.
Just remember, we're taking August 31st.
Okay. Non-refundable.
It's a lot of work for you retired.
I love this place.
Thank you. When I get my next speed.
Thank you.
stay invisible until they're needed.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't want to do that. Why not? Just trust me.
Did you get any sleep after
last night?
No. You look like you need to.
What we need is we need a baby girl to
fall asleep.
Oh, we need everybody to take a nap all the same time.
That would be good.
Oh my God, your laptop's been stolen.